geography at places, and talk a little bit about the significance of it later, but I won't read through the whole thing. And hopefully we'll have time for questions. Okay, here's how my chapter begins. Soon after childbirth in 1843, Mary Elizabeth Leitner became very sick with inflammation of the bowels and almost died, according to her autobiography. Her mother was called to come tender, and she arrived with consecrated oil. Quote, "She anointed me and prayed for me," wrote Mary, and she began to convalesce. After lying in bed for 2 weeks without letting anyone touch her or move her, which caused her excruciating pain, she allowed herself to be lifted out of bed, wrapped in quilts, and placed in a rocking chair. Her mother could then change her bed sheets. As she lay in the chair, a sudden storm broke outside, quote, "and our house was struck by lightning and all of us badly shocked. The door casing was torn out and struck mother on the shoulder and bruised her terribly. All were senseless for some time," end quote. Mary regained consciousness first, looked around at her household of six, and thought they were all dead. She called for her husband Adam and received no answer. She was able to walk into the next room and found Adam rigid as if dead. When she threw a bucket of water over him, he did not move. A doctor was sent for, wrapped Mary in a quilt again, and after a long time managed to revive Adam. This revivification was extremely painful for him. He later said that at the time he would have preferred death. Mary's children and mother all revived. Mary, however, had been entirely cured of her illness. She reports that people came from miles around to see their house, which had been torn to pieces. This is but one of many extraordinary incidents in Mary Elizabeth Rollins' long, varied life. She was a polyandrous wife of Joseph Smith, which means that she was married to another man when Joseph Smith married her. And she married both Joseph and Brigham Young while still cohabiting with her first husband, Adam Leitner. But in contrast to Zina and Presendia Huntington, she never left her first husband, even though he was a non-Mormon. Curiously, Adam was never antagonistic toward Mormonism and was content to live among Mormons for most of his life, including 20 years in Utah, where he died. Mary Elizabeth, like Presendia Huntington, Liza Beeman, and Patty and Sylvia Sessions, lost children under tragic circumstances and lived a difficult life. As she grew old in southern Utah, she felt isolated and neglected by the church. Nevertheless, she remained a faithful Mormon, retained her reverence for Joseph Smith, and frequently gave public speeches in which she testified that she had been married to him. She left us the short autobiography, some sketches and talks, and a number of letters. The autobiography is a remarkable document, moralistic, heroizing, and full of the miraculous. The centerpiece of the story is Joseph Smith as omniscient seer, who makes a prophecy about Mary's life that is fulfilled in all its details. Miracle and prophecy were the neo-biblical psychic environment in which early Mormons lived. Okay, Mary Elizabeth Rollins was born on April 9th, 1818. She had two siblings, an older brother, James Henry, and a younger sister, Caroline. And when she was about two, her father was drowned on Lake Erie. So she was raised without a father. And her family moved in with her aunt, who was married to Algernon Sidney Gilbert. And he, of course, was a partner with Newell Whitney in the Whitney Gilbert Whitney store. And so they were in place there in Kirtland when Mormonism came in, and they were soon converted. Mary was baptized in November 1830, so she was a very early convert. And the rest of her family was converted too. Oh, and by the way, how many here have seen Legacy, the movie Legacy? Okay, the early part of Legacy is based on the autobiography of Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner. And so at this point we have the incident that starts out Legacy where Mary Elizabeth borrows, what happened was she borrowed a Book of Mormon from Isaac Morley, and the Book of Mormon was a great rarity, and in fact she wrote, "If any person in the world was ever perfectly happy in the possession of any coveted treasure, I was when I had permission to read that wonderful book." And he allowed her to take it overnight, even though he didn't think she would get much time to read it. And of course she and her family read through the whole of First Nephi, and she memorized the first verse. And when she returned the book, Isaac remarked, "I guess you did not read much in it." So she recited the first verse and told him about 1 Nephi. And so he said, he gazed at me in surprise and said, "Child, take this book home and finish it. I can wait." So when Joseph Smith came to Kirtland, he visited the Gilbert House and saw a Book of Mormon, which was a rarity, and said, "How did you get the Book of Mormon?" And they said, "Oh, our Mary Elizabeth." You know, and they told her the story. And so he wanted to meet her. Mary writes, "I was sent for. When he saw me," Joseph Smith, "he looked at me so earnestly, I felt almost afraid. And I thought, he can read my every thought. And I thought, how blue his eyes are. After a moment or two, he came and put his hands on my head and gave me a great blessing, the first I ever received, and made me a present of the book." And so here we see how very charismatic Joseph Smith was. And we also see the beginnings of a very important concept in this autobiography, that is, Joseph Smith was close to omniscient. Notice she says, "He can read my every thought." A few evenings later, they attended a little gathering at the Smith house, and it turned into an informal meeting, and Joseph Smith started preaching. And after praying and singing, Joseph talked and then suddenly stopped. Quote, "And his countenance shone and seemed almost transparent. It seems as though the solemnity of eternity rested upon all of us. He seemed almost transfixed. He was looking ahead and his face outshone the candle, which was on a shelf just behind him. I thought I could almost see the cheekbones. He looked as though a searchlight was inside his face and shining through every pore. I could not take my eyes from his face." Then Joseph said, "Who do you suppose has been in your midst this night?" Someone mentioned an angel, but Joseph did not answer. Then Martin Harris dropped to his knees and clasped Joseph's legs. Quote, "I know, Brother Joseph, it was our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." Joseph replied, "Martin, the Spirit of God revealed that to thee. Yes, brethren, our Savior has been in your midst and talked with me face to face. And he has given me a commandment to give unto you. He has commanded me to seal you up unto everlasting life. And he has given you all to me to be with me in his kingdom, even as he is in the Father's kingdom. And he has commanded me to say unto you that when you are tempted of Satan, to get thee behind me, Satan, for my salvation is secure." So here we have a transfiguration experience, very interestingly described by Mary. Like other of Joseph Smith's plural wives, she received the gift of tongues at an early age. She heard Oliver Cowdery and Thomas B. Marsh speak in tongues and prayed that she would be able to understand what they were saying. So one night the brethren were at the Gilbert home and were filled with the Spirit and speaking in tongues. And Mary was called upon to interpret it, and she says she felt the spirit of it in a moment. And one time when she was 14, she interpreted one of Oliver Cowdery's sermons spoken in an Indian language, reportedly. And when she was done, she says an Indian agent who was present came up and asked her where she had learned the language. And so, kind of like proof of the miracle she had performed. Okay, she and her family were very early settlers in Jackson County, Missouri. And so she witnessed the mobbings, and there's just a little vignette from this period in the movie Legacy. What happened was W.W. Phelps was printing the early version of the Book of Doctrine and Covenants, the Book of Commandments, and the mob was tearing apart the printing shop, and Mary and her sister Caroline rushed in, grabbed some of the sheets of the Book of Commandments, and ran away with them into a cornfield, and the mob came after them, but they were able to lose themselves in the cornfield. Very exciting story. There's just a little brief reference to that in Legacy. But the Mormons were driven out of Jackson County, and Mary tells this story as they were getting ready to cross the Missouri River. "While we were camped on the banks of the Missouri River, waiting to be ferried over, They found there was not money enough to take all over. One or two families must be left behind, and the fear was that if left, they would be killed. So some of the brethren thought they would try and catch some fish. Perhaps the ferrymen would take them. They put out their lines in the evening. It rained all night and most of the next day. When they took in their lines, they found two or three small fish and a catfish that weighed 14 pounds. On opening it, what was their astonishment to find three bright silver half dollars, just the amount needed to pay for taking their team over the river. For the Higbee brothers. This was considered a miracle and caused great rejoicing among us. And of course, we immediately think back to the New Testament, where Christ was asked to pay a tax and got the money from a fish, just exactly as it occurred here. Okay. On August 11th, 1835, Mary Elizabeth married Adam Leitner, a non-Mormon, native of Missouri. And they lived in Missouri in Liberty for a while, and Adam opened a store, and she bore her first child June 18th, 1836. And while she was in Far West, she had another supernatural experience that's very interesting, so I want to read that now. Okay, and by the way, her autobiography is found in a number of different versions. I'm trying to sort them out to edit the autobiography. But it's very interesting. I found a holograph version that's very full, but there are all these type scripts running around, and one version was published in the Utah Genealogical and History magazine, and it's very interesting to see how these different versions have been edited, and often the type scripts, you know, a lot of the more interesting things have been taken out. So this story here is in none of the edited or published versions that I found. We have been troubled in Mary Elizabeth is, she'll explain that. We've been troubled for some time with curious phenomena of noises. Our dishes would apparently be thrown from the cupboard onto broken and thrown onto the floor in hundreds of pieces. We would be wakened by a crash, and on lighting a candle, we would find everything as we had left it. But as soon as we blew out the light, the noise would commence again and continued night after night, until we had to keep a light burning all night to get any sleep. But one night, Mr. Leitner was detained in Far West and did not get home as he said he would. My stepsister, Selina Burke, was staying with me, so we waited supper until 9 o'clock, then sat up until near midnight, hoping he would come. At length, we concluded to go upstairs and sleep, rather than sleep in my bed below stairs. I saw all safe for the night and retired. Just as I blowed out the light, we heard the heavy tread of a man on the frozen snow, whose feet seemed to crush through the crust of the snow. He came to the door and walked to the fireplace. I thought it was Mr. Leitner and was on the point of speaking to him when the person turned and walked out, slamming the door after him. I knew then that it was not Mr. Leitner. There was an opening of boards in the front of the bed, extending the whole length of the room, so by leaning over a little, I could see what was going on below. Presently, the person returned and apparently threw a log of wood on the floor and rolled it to the fireplace. Then began a terrible time. We had considerable money in the house that was sent flying over the floor. Bureau drawers and trunks opened, log chains brought in and rattled over chairs, tables, etc. We were so frightened we could hardly breathe. It seemed as though every hair on my head stood straight up, for I thought it was a Negro, and I expected we would be murdered. Selina was crying, and I held my hand over her mouth for fear a sound would escape her, that they, if there was more than one, should hear and come upstairs if the rumpus continued until break of day. We did not dare to go down until the sun was high in the heavens, for I thought we were robbed of all our money and our furniture ruined. No one can imagine our surprise when we found everything in order as we had left it the night before, and the door locked. We left the house and went a short distance to Mr. Leitner's mother's. When he saw us, she was so frightened she could hardly speak, for she said we looked like two ghosts, and we felt as though we were pretty near being that. It was months before I recovered from the terrible shock of my nerves and general health, which was badly shattered. Okay, so that's kind of a typical ghost story, isn't it? It starts out with poltergeist, and typical ghost storytelling, you know, the hair standing up on the head and everything. Right in the middle of our New Testament type miracles, we have this kind of standard ghost story. Okay. Of course, the Mormons were driven out of far west, that part of Missouri, and went to Illinois, and Mary and Adam went out of state, but eventually they returned to Nauvoo. And she had a couple kids by this time. Her second child, Caroline, was born October 18, 1840. And so now we come to the marriage to Joseph Smith. So I'm going to read this at length so you don't think I'm editorializing. It's a very interesting account. Okay, in the meantime, Brother Joseph and Brother Brigham came to see me and invited me to go next day to his office in the brick store. I was surprised at this. He asked me if I was afraid to go. I replied, "Why should I be afraid of a prophet of God?" He said, "Brother Young would come for me." That night I dreamed I was married to him, to Joseph, and occupied an upper room in a new house. In the morning we were called to breakfast. This is still part of the dream, and I wondered what Emma would say to me, for I was afraid of her. But Joseph took me by the hand and led me downstairs, at the foot of which stood Emma smiling at us, and conducted us to the breakfast room. I awoke then, well, you can tell it must have been a dream, huh? Because Emma was so positive. I awoke then and did not know what to think of my dream. Okay, here's Mormons. The early Mormons were very paid great attention to their dreams, and so here we have a prophetic dream that Mary Elizabeth has. But on going to the office next day, I received the interpretation for what was my astonishment when Joseph made known to me that God had commanded him in July 1834 to take me for a wife, but he had not dared to make it known to me, for when he received the revelation, I was in Missouri, and when he did see me, I was married. But he was again commanded to fulfill the first revelation, or suffer condemnation. For I was created for him before the foundation of the earth was laid. Okay, so you have to remember, here's Joseph Smith proposing to a woman who is married and has kids. So what is Mary's reaction? I said, "If the Lord told you such a thing, why don't he come and tell me?" Furthermore, I never would consent to be sealed to him unless I had a witness for myself. He told me a great many other things concerning the order and the blessings pertaining to it and etc. I felt that he and I was both wrong, for I had dreamed for years that I belonged to him and had besought the Lord to take away such thoughts from my heart. No human being can tell my feelings on this occasion. My faith in him as prophet almost failed me. I could not sleep and scarcely eat. Next day, Brother Young came to see me and said, after we left the office, Joseph told him that an angel appeared to him and that I should have a witness that what he told me was true. I marveled at this, but made it a subject of prayer night and day. One night in February, I felt impressed to pray as, this is early 1842, by the way, I felt impressed to pray as Moses did in the Battle of Israel with the Amalekites by holding up my hands towards heaven. I also covered my head with a white cloth, and I prayed with all my soul that if the doctrine was true, to give me a witness of the same. Again, very interesting how tied up she is in the Bible and is going to do everything exactly as she read it in the Bible. One night I retired to bed, but not to sleep, for my mind was troubled, so sleep fled from me. My Aunt Gilbert was sleeping with me at the time, when a great light appeared in the room. Thinking the kindling wood was on fire that was spread on the hearth, I rose up in bed to look, when lo, a personage stood in front of the bed looking at me. Its clothes were whiter than anything I had ever seen. I could look at its person, but when I saw its face so bright and more beautiful than any earthly being could be, and those eyes piercing me through and through, I could not endure it. It seemed as if I must die with fear. I fell back in bed and covered up my head so as not to see it. I pushed Aunt very hard to have her look up and see it too. But I could not wake her, and I could not speak. I thought if she were awake, I would not feel so afraid. As it is, I can never forget that face. It seems to be ever before me. A few days after this, Joseph asked me if I had received a witness yet. I said, no, he said, you will soon have, for the angel expressly told me you should. You should have. Then I told him what I had seen, for I fully realized what I had lost by my cowardice. The family all said they knew something had happened to me, for my countenance was almost transparent. So she almost was transfigured. And when I told them of it, there was great rejoicing, and they felt that I had been highly favored of the Lord. As yet, they knew nothing of what Joseph had said to me. So Mary Elizabeth is almost a prophet in her own right. When Joseph had inquired about the appearance of the person, and I had told him, he seemed much affected and told me it was an angel from God, and that it came fraught with more knowledge and revelation than he dare reveal at that time, and that if I had prayed in my heart to God, all fear would have left me. As it was, Satan snatched the cup from my lips. He told me of many things to take place soon in my life, as a sign of the truth of what he had revealed to me. Here we have Joseph Smith knowing the future in detail. His words were verified, testimonies I felt I could no longer disbelieve. And in the month of March 1841, Brigham Young sealed us for time and all eternity. In other places she said 1842, which we know from checking on various things, 1842 is the correct date. Willard Richards and Heber C. Kimball knew of it, but were not present. Okay, so that's a very, very important passage because of the 11 women who Joseph Smith married polyandrously. We only have two accounts, this one and another one, of how he approached them. And even though we would like more, we would like a longer explanation. That's very interesting. Especially interesting is the fact that Joseph Smith told her, you were given to me in the pre-existence. And this is a link with a larger pattern called the spiritual wife doctrine that was very prevalent in the burned over district of New York at the time. The idea that certain people had special affinities for each other that would take precedence over an earthly marriage. And so this, the kind of doctrine that Joseph Smith was preaching here fits in with that. So that's very important. Also the idea that you were given to me. Often Joseph Smith, when he approached his wives, he kind of looked at the marriage as something that had been done previously by God, and the woman should simply comply with what had been given by God. Also of interest is the fact that when he received resistance, as he often did, he would encourage the woman to pray about it. He would teach them the gospel of polygamy, encourage them to pray about it, and he would promise a spiritual experience. And in this case, Mary Elizabeth had her spiritual experience. Okay, so she was married to Joseph Smith. However, as again was common of these polyandrous marriages, she did not leave Adam Leitner. And in another place she wrote, I could tell you why I stayed with Mr. Leitner, things the leaders of the church does not know anything about. Then she underlines this, I did just as Joseph told me to do, as he knew what troubles I would have to contend with. So again, that's very important, showing that Joseph evidently told her to stay with her first husband. Adam Leitner evidently always had problems providing for his family. And July 1st, 1842, Adam had not been able to find work in Nauvoo, evidently, and he found work 15 miles up the river in Pontoosuc. So he bought a log house there, and Mary prepared to go with him. And however, Joseph was distraught at this. And Mary wrote, Joseph felt very sad, and while the tears ran down his cheeks, he prophesied that if we attempted to leave the church, we would have plenty of sorrow, for we would make property on the right hand and lose it on the left. We would have sickness on sickness and lose our children, and I would have to work harder than I ever dreamed of. And at last, when you are worn out and almost ready to die, you will get back to the church. And the rest of Mary Elizabeth's autobiography is written to show how this prophecy was fulfilled. However, at the time, Mary thought these were hard sayings, she says, as her life had already been about as hard as possible. So she prepared to leave, and Joseph rebaptized the Rollins and Leitner families before she left. And then he tried hard to get Mr. Leitner to go into the water. But Adam said he did not feel worthy. So this relationship between the two husbands of Mary is very interesting. There was never any antagonism that we know of. Though my working theory is that Adam Leitner did not know of the marriage of his wife to Joseph Smith. Okay, so in Pontusic, this is where the lightning struck her house. And maybe this was the first disaster in, you know, all of these misfortunes that she felt Joseph Smith had prophesied. Then she got very sick. She said the whole family had fevers and chills for 6 months. And she contracted bilious fever. I'm not sure what that is. Sounds bad. But she had a dream in which an angel came to her and told her that if she went to Nauvoo and asked for a brother Cutler who worked on the temple to administer her, she would be sealed. So here we have, again, the prophetic dream, the appearance of the angel in the dream. She wanted to obey the warning but could not obtain a team, but her brother sent a team. And so she was put on this cart along with Adam and her children. And she says, while she was traveling, a green liquid began to flow from her mouth. That was edited out of the TypeScript versions, but I like that detail. And the hue of death was on my countenance. When the Leitners arrived in Nauvoo, Mary asked if there was a brother Cutler who worked on the temple. They went up and got Alpheus Cutler. And of course, it's miraculous that she would know the name, because evidently, according to the context of the story, she didn't know him previously. He came and ministered to Mary, and immediately she wrote, I got up and walked to the fire alone in 2 weeks. I was able to take care of my children. So a miraculous healing. Okay, Joseph Smith died, of course, June 27, 1844. So she lost the second of her two husbands. However, Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball married many of Joseph Smith's plural wives. And so at some point, Brigham Young proposed to Mary Elizabeth, and unfortunately we don't have the account of that, but Mary accepted, and in early 1845 she was married to Brigham Young. On May 22nd, 1845, she wrote, I was also sealed to Brigham Young as proxy for Joseph, end quote. However, she continued to live with Adam, as before. In the Nauvoo Temple, she was again sealed to Brigham Young. Of course, Adam Leitner could not go into the temple and stand as proxy for Joseph Smith, so she had the proxy marriage to Joseph Smith and was sealed to Brigham for time again in the temple. She was in kind of an ambiguous situation now, as she had been with Joseph Smith and Adam. She continued to live with Adam, but evidently she felt a strong tie with Brigham. And so a very vivid moment in the autobiography is she was at home, and her stepfather came into the house and said Brigham Young and his family were crossing the Mississippi on the ice. Quote, I felt stunned. The thought came to me that polygamy was of the devil, and Brigham knew it, or he would have cut off his right hand before he would have left me. Okay, remember, this is Mary Elizabeth writing many years later, you know, when she's a very strongly believing Mormon. So I think this shows how devastating this was to her when one of her two husbands left her. I wept myself sick and felt to give up and go among the Gentiles. In fact, I felt as though I was like one in any open boat at sea without compass or rudder. Brigham, after he reached Winter Quarters, sent word to Mary to come join the saints there. One wonders if he sent word to Adam also. But the Leitners were experiencing utter poverty at the time and did not even have sufficient clothes to wear, Mary says, let alone a wagon and a team. So instead they moved to Galena in the northwestern corner of Illinois. The next major event took place in 1847. They moved up into Wisconsin. For a number of years, she and her husband worked as hotel proprietors in the Wisconsin-Missouri area. in the River of St. Croix, and at times were very successful. This next event happened when they were doing this. Let's see, baby came down with chills and fever. Mary tended her, noticed her feet were beginning to swell and turn purple. The swelling retreated. She didn't have to have her foot amputated, as some doctors had recommended. Aunt Gilbert came to visit during this crisis and stayed. Aunt Gilbert was the widow of Algernon Gilbert, who had died in Zion's camp. In the latter part of 1847, a traveling salesman came to the Leitner home selling a root that was supposed to be a cure-all. He offered samples to the Leitners, and the whole family tasted it, including Aunt Gilbert. In a few moments, they were all violently ill, and Mary's 11-year-old son, Miles, and her 4-year-old son, Florentine, died quickly. Aunt Gilbert was pronounced dead and was laid under sheets with the two boys. Doctors, when they arrived, felt that Mary and Adam would also die, but they recovered. Then, to the amazement of all, Aunt Gilbert began to have convulsions. She was alive. She survived the poisoning, although she continued to have convulsions for 2 weeks. The poisoner was captured, and they were going to hang him in front of Mary's window, and she said, "No, I want a trial." He escaped, but he got lost in the woods and had frostbite on his feet and had pain in his feet the rest of his life. And so Mary writes, "He could escape men, but not God." So here we have the theme of the punishment of God on evildoers. This was a devastating blow for her, losing her two sons. But she continued to have more children. In 1853... she received a Three Nephites story in the autobiography. And then she and her husband went into debt to buy a hotel that they could own themselves, and bought a big hotel and a big home, and things were going very well for them. And but then the Civil War started, and a number of their boarders left to enlist. They couldn't meet the mortgage and lost their property. And again, this was a devastating blow, and Mary remembered Joseph's prophecy and felt that she had suffered enough. It was time to go back to Utah, to go back with the saints. So they sent a message to Henry, who was in Minersville in southern Utah, and eventually he sent back help, and they went to Utah. And the autobiography ends when they get to Utah. And as often happens, early Mormons felt that when you got to Utah, history was kind of done. You know, the very interesting, important things happened before you got to Utah. In early Utah, it was just daily life. So her autobiography ends when they get to Utah. But she felt that all of the terrible things that had happened to her after she left Nauvoo were a direct result of this prophecy of Joseph Smith. Okay, so the latter half of her life we can trace by a number of different sources. We have a number of letters written to her and some letters written by her, and we can figure some things out by these letters. Her relationship with Brigham was interesting. She was very friendly, but still somewhat distant. She and Adam settled in Minersville, which is far away from Salt Lake. And she wrote this: "The authorities stopped at our home many times, and Brigham always came to see us. He would have moved us to the city if I would go." So you're not sure exactly what's going on there, but you know that Mary stayed with Adam, and Mary and Adam stayed in Minersville. Her children grew up, began to marry, have kids. In an 1887 letter, Mary described a meeting she had with Brigham Young, who, the last time but one that he was south, sent for me and told me that he had bought a house in the city for me, and that hereafter my family should be provided for, that I had suffered enough and the Lord did not require me to suffer anymore. So we see Brigham's interest in Mary. However, she then notes with a touch of bitterness that Young had not followed through on his promises. Quote, "I never received the house or anything, for I suppose he forgot all about me, having more important business to attend to." So in her later life, it's very clear from the letters that she felt that she had not been properly provided for by the church. And a number of the letters were written to ask why money had not been sent as it had been requested. Adam Leitner died on August 19th, 1885, of consumption, which I guess is tuberculosis. The major event that happened soon after that was her oldest son, her youngest son, Adam Leitner Jr., was convicted of larceny and was put in jail. And she worked tirelessly to get him out of jail, to get him pardoned and get him out of jail. And she was finally successful in doing that, but it took a lot of work. She had made trips up to Salt Lake City, talked to the governor, talked to church leaders, felt that Adam Jr. was not really responsible, and eventually got him released. In her later life, she had close ties with other of the plural wives of Joseph Smith, and we have letters written to them and letters they wrote to her. Zina Huntington Young, Emily Partridge Young, Eliza Snow. She was very friendly with all of these women. Emmeline Wells. We have letters to and from Emmeline. I don't have time to read them. Sometimes they're with complaints, but sometimes she talks about what her life was like. She was active in the Relief Society. As she got older and older, she was seen as, as a historical treasure. And so in her late life, she gave many speeches, public speeches, and she often bore witness of her marriage to Joseph Smith and retold that story. It wasn't something that she kept secret in any way. And we have one of her speeches that she gave to the students at BYU, in which she went through the whole story. She lived through the 1880s, through the 1890s, and on into the 20th century. And April 14th, 1905, when she was 87, she spoke to the graduating class of Brigham Young University. Last document we have from her that I know of is a letter she wrote to her local bishop on April 20th, 1904, complaining that her normal tithing office payment had not arrived. And I close my chapter with this incident, though I'm not sure exactly what the chronology of it is. When Heber C. Kimball was still alive, one time he told her that Joseph would return to her and visit her. So one night, much later after Heber C. Kimball had died, she was sitting on her porch humming the pioneer hymn, All Is Well, and musing. Quote, "Suddenly I saw just outside the door three men. They stood about 2 feet from the ground. These men were the prophet Joseph, his brother Hiram, and Heber C. Kimball. Joseph stood in the middle with an arm around each of their shoulders. They were bowing and smiling to me. Now I was looking into those clear blue penetrating eyes as I had done years ago when he had answered my many questions about the gospel. I looked around, pinched my arm to see if I was dreaming. As they were still smiling and bowing, I thought I would shake hands with them. They saw my confusion and understood it, and they laughed, and I thought Brother Kimball would kill himself laughing." I really like that detail, the laughing angel or the laughing spirit or something. "I thought Brother Kimball would kill himself laughing. I had no fear. Trembling with joy, I arose, took a step forward, and extended my hand. They began fading away as the going down of the sun." On December 21st, 1910, her daughter, Caroline Leitner Jewell, died. So Mary Leitner, after burying three husbands, had buried 6 of her 10 children. She herself finally died on December 17th, 1913, passing away in Minersville, Beaver, Utah, at the age of 95. She had outlived the first 4 presidents of the Latter-day Saint Church, the first 2 of whom had been her husbands. She was the last of Joseph's wives to die, and one of the only 4 who would live into the 20th century. After living a life full of miracle and tragedy, it was time for her to rest. And now I've run out of time, and I have my summation, which I really ought to read, so I'll try to do it quick, and then we'll have questions. I find the supernaturalism in her writings very interesting. As you've seen, the autobiography is steeped in the miraculous, speaking in tongues, with the verification that she was speaking in Indian language, angelic visitations, prophetic dreams, transfigurations. She saw Joseph Smith. She herself was transfigured at one point. A 3 Nephite appearance, the fish caught with the exact amount of money for the driven saints in its stomach, which is in parallel to the New Testament. And then Joseph Smith's prophecies fulfilled to the letter, which portrays him as a supernatural figure bordering on the omniscient. And finally, the visit from Joseph, Hiram, and Heber C. Kimball. Many of these miracles are explicitly biblical. The early Latter-day Saints were Christian primitivist restorationists, but they did not just believe in the Bible, they saw themselves as living the Bible. And I think Mary's autobiography shows a thirst for the miraculous and indicates that they saw as important what they saw as important or attractive in the Bible. I think the miracles in Joseph Smith's story were also extremely attractive to early Mormon converts. Joseph Smith as infallible prophet was almost seen as a miracle embodied. But the poltergeist, I think, is important in that it shows Mary was also receptive to non-biblical supernaturalism. Just as early Mormons often believed in the Searstone treasure-digging treasure guardian folklore. How do we deal with this kind of rampant supernaturalism in early Mormonism, we 20th century Mormons? Frankly, I've been a Mormon all my life and never had a single supernatural experience such as Mary's. Unfortunately, no one speaks in tongues in priesthood meeting now. Do we reject her supernaturalism, or do we accept all of it, which is difficult to do for some reasons? I think this is an important philosophical issue that faces Mormonism, looking at this kind of supernaturalism sympathetically, yet looking at it with a kind of scientific skepticism. It's a difficult tightrope act to navigate. Thank you. Perry, right? Perry? Okay.
Did you find any more evidence that her Mary's father had actually run away from the family and went off rather than had been killed and drowned in that
No, that's totally new to me, and this is a descendant of that man. He said, do you find any evidence that Mary Elizabeth's father actually ran off instead of was drowned in a boat?
Some of the accounts, they say he was seen later in Colorado. People claim that they saw him. They think he just ran off and abandoned his family.
That's totally new to me. He says that there are accounts that people saw him later in Colorado. I'd like some verification of it. That'd be interesting. And that's from a descendant of the man, too. So, do you believe it, Perry?
I don't know. It's confusing. I think there's a possibility that he left the family and ran off, but I don't know why.
Uh-huh. He says that it's confusing. He doesn't know. He thinks there's a possibility that he left, but he doesn't know why.
One
that's
follow-up.
So many things in history, you say, I'd like to get verification, but it's possible, you know.
One yeah. Follow-up question. Did you find anything significant about Mary's mother being Jewish? Was there anything along that line that they found?
He says, did I find anything about Mary's mother being Jewish, about the significance of that? And she had a very... I've actually never even thought about this, so that's very interesting. She had a very interesting name, Keziah, which is from the Old Testament, which is common in early America, a lot of these odd Old Testament names. But she was Jewish then, was she? Yeah, very interesting.
And Ben Wilson's Jewish.
Well, that's a Dutch... That, yeah,
Dutch.
It's a Dutch name, but there can be Jews in Holland. but I haven't pursued this at all. This is something that's interesting. I'd like to know more about it at some point. And that would fit in with Mary feeling herself, you know, as a prophetess and feeling this link with the Old Testament, which she obviously did. Yeah?
To what extent do you think marriage implied sexual relationships on an extended basis?
Track down my article in Dialogue, and I discuss that at some length. So for the evidence, go look for that. But my working hypothesis is that Joseph Smith had sexual relations with the polyandrous wives and with what I call the single wives, and that the only wives who I think possibly he didn't have sexual relations with were the older women that he married. But again, I'd have to go into the evidence for that. There's very complex evidence, and we would like more evidence. So that's my working hypothesis. And there is evidence for that. You could take a different stand on that based on the evidence.
Anything in Mary's words to reflect some kind of romantic relationship?
Well, there's stuff in her words to reflect a romantic relationship. She said from the very beginning, you can see how she was struck by Joseph Smith's eyes. You can tell that she was very attracted to him. She said she'd been dreaming about him for years as a husband and had felt guilty about it. But as far as sexual relations, I've found no evidence that she talked about sexual relations with Joseph Smith. She did say one very interesting thing. She said she knew, like four or five children of Joseph Smith who were raised under another name. And some people have theorized possibly one of these was one of her children. But that's totally a theory.
Would her husband have known of this going on?
Well, one thing I didn't bring out, but she says that he was not there when the marriage took place. And as he was a non-member, my working hypothesis is that they did not tell him of the marriage. And again, our documentation on these polyandrous marriages is very sparse because these women did not write about it. And the first husbands, we have, as I say, of the 11 women who married Joseph Smith polyandrously, we have only these two accounts, and I've read one of them, and today. And so there's a lot we don't know about them. And of the first husbands, we do not have a single autobiographical account. In the relationship of Zina Huntington and Henry Jacobs and Joseph Smith, there seems to be evidence that Henry Jacobs knew about the marriage. But he was a member. He was a member, and he was very much a disciple of Joseph Smith. So I think they might have felt that he could know about it. But I think with someone like Adam, who was a non-member, I don't think it would have been a good policy to tell him about the marriage. Yeah?
The first of the polyandrous marriages, and was it the only one in which the husband was a non-member?
No, it wasn't the first. She asked if this was the first of the polyandrous marriages. Off the top of my head, what were they before this? Lucinda, Pendleton Harris, and Zina Huntington Jacobs, Presendia, Huntington Buell. Those are all before 1842. So she was at least the fourth. And I don't have my list in front of me. She might have been. But she was one of the very earliest ones. But and what was the second part of your question? Oh, in the marriage to Buell, he was a member, but he was very disaffected from the church. And I should have my list in front of me. There was at least one other non-member. Who was that? Cleveland, John Cleveland. Augusta Kingsley, not Augusta, Sarah Kingsley Cleveland. She was married to a non-member, John Cleveland. But I don't have my list in front of me. Again, go dig up that dialogue article. Yeah?
Just in terms of your view.
This gentleman asks how this, I think, the practice of polyandry carried down into the later church. Brigham Young, as we've seen, practiced polyandry, in fact, even with Mary Elizabeth. And in a few other cases, he did too. But other than that, it was very rare. And I haven't studied later in the church. I know Mike Quinn told me about one case that had nothing to do with these elite figures. But it was very much a Joseph Smith thing, which kind of hung over with Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball a little bit. But then it very much died out. And I think you can see the problems. Because people defend it by saying, well, Mary Elizabeth was married to Adam Leitner, who could not save her. She could not have a celestial marriage with Adam Leitner. Okay, and, well, let's take that to the mission field today. we have a part member family, and so the wife marries, without the husband's knowing, marries a good member of the church so she can get salvation, and later the husband converts. He says, oh, great, we can go to the temple now. She said, oh, by the way, I'm already married to this other person, but you can marry some other person for eternity, which is, you can see the problems. Well,
we got time for about one more question.
Okay, this gentleman here.
I'm past master of Masonic Lodge. I'm interested in the Masonic connection. Was the wife married to a Mason? I know Brigham Young was a Mason, and also Joseph Smith was a Mason.
He asked about the ties with Masonry, and I left some of that out, but I think you're asking if Adam Leitner was a Mason, which would be an interesting case, because the Masons have this oath not to be involved with the wives of other Masons. I don't know if Adam was a Mason, but there's some interesting tie-ins with Masonry here. The marriage took place in the upper room of Joseph Smith's store, which was called the Masonic Hall. And so there are tie-ins with Relief Society, and which I think was organized here. Right. And some people think that Relief Society was involved with Joseph Smith introducing Masonry. And so there are some interesting connections. And Mary Elizabeth, in her autobiography, she said she helped do the costumes for the endowment, which are connected with Masonic costumes. So there's some interesting connections there.
Mom, when is your book coming out?
Who said that? you might know better than I would.
I'm sure I don't.
The last I heard was something like June or August. Don't hold your breath. Something like that.
Thank you.
Thanks.